The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Susan Dellinger from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Oprah Magazine, October 2018, Volume 20, Number 10. And this is the second of four installments of the October issue. On this month's cover, in a close-up, Oprah clasps a silver sequined hood in each hand. Her long caramel-colored waves fall out from under the hood. Her dramatic pewter eyeshadow shimmers, and her lipstick is a pale mauve. This month's big question is, what's beautiful to you? Let's start off this second installment with The World According to Gail. And in the upper right-hand corner, we have a picture of Gail in a red short-sleeve dress standing beside Bradley Cooper. And he's wearing a blue dress shirt and a navy blazer. And then there's a little inset from the movie A Star is Born. A very shaggy, bearded Bradley Cooper is playing guitar and leaning forward, and his forehead is touching Lady Gaga's forehead. But she's not all glamorous like we see her on the stage in this movie. She's got kind of mousy brown hair, and it's pulled up in a pigtail. She's holding a microphone, and she's singing. So this is what we need to watch, according to Gail. The film A Star is Born has been made not once, not twice, but three times, and now I'm excited to see the fourth, directed by Bradley Cooper, out October 5th. The Oscar nominee also stars in the movie as hard-drinking crooner Jackson Maine, who discovers an unknown talent named Allie, played this time by Lady Gaga. Bradley told me this project was both exciting and scary because he had to sing live, but I bet the pair will be in perfect harmony. And the item below that is under the big heading, Read. America Ferrera, who was named after her Honduran mother, not the United States of you-know-what, grew up with roots in both Central America and the U.S., which is why she asked friends like Issa Rae and Michelle Kwan to write about how it feels to straddle two worlds for the new collection, American Like Me. The essays are heartfelt reminders that our country has been great for a while now. And there's a picture of the book cover, which is red, and it big yellow letters say American Like Me. And there's an inset of America Ferrera, and she doesn't look at all like the character from Ugly Betty with the big glasses and the braces. She's very glamorous with her hair sort of blowing. It's a nice studio shot, and she's looking very serious. Oh, below this, we have the heading Eat. And there's a picture of a restaurant in Montreal, and it's a office building that overlooks the city, and it's all very industrial. The ceiling is completely exposed, so we see all the conduit for the wiring and the HVAC system. Floor-to-ceiling windows overlooking the city, lots of tables, very industrial-looking, those kind of 1970s fiberglass chairs, which we all probably remember from school. And then, on the long table in the middle, there are 3-foot-tall, elegant, ornate, silver candelabra. Sometimes a simple Google search can lead to a spectacular experience, says Gail. That's how my favorite son Will and I felt after we found Les Enfants Terribles au Somerset Place, Ville-Marie, during a trip to Montreal. The meal's standout was the pudding chaumière. The saucy, spongy dish is the one dessert that has made me go, sweet tooth, you've met your match. And there's a picture of this dessert, a white plate, and there's a pudding cup on one side with this sort of caramel-doused spongy cake, I'm assuming. And then that's over on one side of the white dish, and then there are raspberries, a couple of blueberries, and a strawberry, and a smear of this caramelly pudding on it and another little dish full of blueberries. Now, under Tune In, we have a picture of Candace Bergen from probably the late 1980s, maybe 1990s. She's wearing a red dress. She's leaning back in an office chair. Her black high heels on her feet are propped up on the desk, and there's some shelving hanging on the wall behind her, and there's an Emmy on that shelf along with some books and magazines. Do you remember what you were doing on November 14th, 1988? Gail says, I sure do. I was watching the first episode of Murphy Brown, the witty workplace sitcom about a TV news magazine. Emmy winner Candace Bergen played the titular Murphy, a smart and ambitious journalist who many women aspired to be. 20 years later, Murphy's back as a morning TV talk show host. The reboot debuted on September 27th, and Candace told me on a recent flight that she looks forward to bringing her into the 21st century. You and me both, Candace. And there's one final thing here on this page of The World According to Gail. And under the big heading note, we have a quote. Confidence is a choice. A big part of being confident is being brave. And you can't be brave unless you're scared. 2 months ago, Gail says, I saw Eighth Grade, a movie about a 13-year-old wannabe YouTube star named Kayla in her final week of middle school. And I can't stop thinking about it. I assumed people either had confidence or didn't, but Kayla's philosophy is spot on. Better to put on big girl pants and be brave, even when you're afraid. Let's move now to the Let's Eat section of the magazine, and this month's singular sensation is pumpkin. And we've got this great picture on the first page against a black backdrop. We have a pile of pumpkins, and they're different varieties. We've got the solid orange ones that we know well, and then there are some that are mottled kind of off-white and orange, and some that are green, and green and white stripes, and sort of variegated looking, and of course all the little curly stems are included in this photograph of all these pumpkins. A delicious celebration of one standout ingredient? This month, pumpkin, a splendidly sweet vegetable that makes for an enchanting fall feast. Why we love them. Pumpkins not only look festive on your table, they add fall flavor to your menu too. You can use their mild, creamy flesh to thicken soups and stews, sweeten salads and stir fries, or create magnificently moist baked goods. And those leftover seeds? Drizzle them with olive oil, sprinkle with salt and rosemary, and roast at 350 degrees for 10 to 15 minutes for a savory afternoon pick-me-up. And here are some tips. Soak freshly scooped seeds in a bowl of water and swish with your hand before drying and roasting them for snacks. You'll help remove stringy pumpkin bits. Next, baking peeled pumpkin chunks at 350 degrees until tender about 45 minutes before pureeing can give you less watery results than steaming or boiling. Large carving pumpkins are often pulpy and bland, so look for sugar, a generic name for multiple cooking types, or Cinderella pumpkins, which tend to be smooth and sweet. And save leftover pumpkin puree for smoothies or future baking. It keeps well in the freezer for up to a year. We have a couple of recipes here, and the first is savory pumpkin and sage soup. This makes 8 servings with a total time of an hour and 30 minutes. Here are the ingredients. 1/4 cup of olive oil, 3 large sweet onions sliced, 1 teaspoon of kosher salt, plus more for sprinkling, 3 garlic cloves chopped, 2 large sage leaves chopped, plus 24 small leaves for garnish, 2 teaspoons of fresh ginger grated and peeled, 1/4 teaspoon of ground nutmeg, 8 cups of vegetable or chicken broth, 3 15-ounce cans of pumpkin puree, 1 tablespoon of lemon juice, a quarter teaspoon of ground black pepper plus more for seasoning, vegetable oil for frying, 7 ounces of shiitake mushrooms stemmed and very thinly sliced. And here are the instructions. In a 5-quart pot, heat olive oil on medium. Add onions and a sprinkle of salt and cook, stirring occasionally until deep golden brown, about 40 minutes. Add garlic, chopped sage, ginger, and nutmeg. Cook until garlic is golden, stirring occasionally, about 5 minutes. Add broth and pumpkin. Over high heat, bring to a simmer, scraping up browned bits from bottom of pot. Reduce heat to maintain simmer and cook 20 minutes, stirring occasionally. With an immersion blender, or in batches in a regular blender, puree soup until it is smooth. Stir in lemon juice, 1 teaspoon of salt, and a quarter teaspoon of pepper. If soup is too thick, add more broth for desired consistency and season to taste with salt and pepper. To make the garnish, in a medium saucepan over high heat, warm 1 inch of vegetable oil until hot but not smoking. Add sage leaves and fry, stirring occasionally until browned, 1 to 2 minutes. With a slotted spoon, transfer to a large paper towel lined plate. Sprinkle with a pinch of salt. To hot oil, add mushrooms in batches and fry, stirring occasionally until golden brown, about 2 minutes. Transfer to plate and sprinkle with a pinch of salt. Cool completely before adding, along with fried sage, to soup. And here's a tip. Try this. For an ultra-indulgent grilled cheese experience, upgrade to chicken soup rather than the classic tomato. Upgrade to pumpkin soup rather than the classic tomato. Now, here's our final recipe, hearty lentil salad with roasted pumpkin. This makes 4 servings with a total time of 45 minutes. And here are the ingredients. 4 cups of peeled pumpkin cut into medium dice. 2 medium apples cut into medium dice. 2 tablespoons of olive oil plus more for drizzling. 1 teaspoon of ground cumin. 4 thyme sprigs. 4 garlic cloves smashed. Kosher salt, ground black pepper, 5 ounces, about 4 cups arugula, 2 cups canned or cooked lentils. Here are the instructions. Heat oven to 375 degrees. On a rimmed baking sheet lined with parchment paper, toss pumpkin and apple with olive oil, cumin, thyme, and garlic. Season with salt and pepper. Roast until fork tender, about 20 minutes. Let cool slightly. Divide arugula, pumpkin mixture, and lentils among 4 plates. Drizzle with olive oil and season with salt and pepper to taste. And now let's look at this month's introductory page for the Live Your Best Life section of the magazine. There's a picture from an apple orchard. It's a close-up of an apple tree that is laden with red apples, and there's a red ladder standing amongst all of the limbs. And here's a quote from Samuel Butler from The Way of All Flesh. Autumn is the mellower season, and what we lose in flowers, we more than gain in fruits. And now let's look at the gratitude meter. 5 things we're smiling about this month, and they go from awe to awesome. And first off, we have a couple of candles, and they're faceted. They're kind of angular, chiseled looking, and one is a pink unicorn, and the other is a blue owl. Meltdown is the little title for this. When most candles flame out, you're left with a sad little stub of wick, but the uncanny pyropets begin in the shape of an animal, cat, dragon, unicorn, bird, bunny, reindeer, or owl, and end as a skeleton sculpture. A little bit spooky, a little bit kooky. Go to us.54celsius.com. And next, Taste Master. Noodle on this. To sneak nutrients onto her son's plate, Linda Miller Nicholson started using fruits like blueberries and veggies like beets to make plaid, pepperadelle, floral, fettuccine, and more. You can explore Nicholson's whimsical creations in her new cookbook, Pasta, Pretty Please, and online at youtube.com/saltyseattle. And we have a lovely picture of a lovely arrangement of the little leaf-shaped pasta, and it's in pinks and blues and greens, and it's arranged almost like a fancy piece of costume jewelry. And in the third spot, it's a smaller world. Want to get to know other cultures? The Alinist, the UN of subscription services, sends a different country-themed box every other month that contains a novel and ethically sourced goods representing far-flung, often misunderstood places. And the box here has its components spread out around it. There's a cup, which I'm wondering is maybe it's full of a coffee or a tea. There's a map. There's a novel. This one is called The Association of Small Bombs, a novel by, I think, Karen Vaughn, maybe. And you go to thealinist.com to find out more. Now, getting closer to awesome, puff piece, it says. It's a parka. It's a footy PJs. It's a wearable sleeping bag. This cocoon with fluffy insulation and removable boots is tough enough for outdoor snoozing, but cozy enough for binge watching on your couch. Suit yourself at silkbagusa.com. And they're shown here in a deep, deep magenta and a bright, bright yellow. They're sort of like an oversized ski suit. The hood is part of it. It zips down the side, and it has the booties that hook on to it. And finally, coming in at awesome, we have a picture of Gilda Radner. Joking aside, no wonder Gilda Radner was SNL, Saturday Night Live's first Not Ready for Primetime player. Her talent was electric, her spirit incandescent. The documentary, Love, Gilda, out now, revisits the comic in her own words and often movingly in her own voice. She was always something. And across the bottom of the page, we have Creature Comforts. And we have this cute little small dog standing on a welcome mat, looking up at us with those big dog eyes. Give a dog a home. In honor of Adopt a Shelter Dog Month, we asked ASPCA President and CEO Matthew Bershadker to break down the current numbers on pups in need. About 3.3 million dogs go into shelters nationwide every year. 1.6 million are adopted. And Matthew says, as of 2011, almost 4 million dogs were entering shelters annually. The figure is dropped because of things like spay-neuter programs, grants given to shelters to provide resources and services to owners who might otherwise relinquish a pet, and people taking pride in adopting from a rescue. Next fact, approximately 670,000 dogs are euthanized annually. Matthew says, dogs are at risk for euthanasia because they're not being properly exercised or socialized. But when shelters get them out of cages and let them express their natural instincts, the results are huge. Dogs relax more in the kennel and show better on the adoption floor. Here's our next fact. 19% of animal shelter intakes in 2016 were pit bull type dogs. 15% were chihuahuas. Matthew says, there are so many pits in shelters because there are so many out in the world, and misperceptions about them contribute to housing bans and breeding-specific legislation in some cities, which creates a challenging adoption environment. Chihuahuas, on the other hand, are popular in the Southwest, but not so much in the Northeast. We've had a lot of success transporting them to regions where people want small dogs. And finally, households with an income below $50,000 are more likely to rehome a pet due to financial concerns. And Matthew says, they're usually rehoming, which means they're giving their dog to a family member or a friend because of a housing issue or being unable to afford vet services. But if we can, we want to keep the animal with them. It could be a matter of a few hundred bucks to pay for a fence, ear infection treatment, or even a collar. No one's tax bracket should keep them from owning a pet. And now this month's celebrity in Live Your Best Life, My Best Life, is Rachel Bloom, the gutsy co-creator and star of the musical comedy Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, returning for its fourth and final season October 12th, Talks, Tub Time, and Nimble Toes. And there's a picture of her here, and she's wearing this ivory shirtwaist dress in this real soft sort of silky fabric, and it's got gathering at the yoke at the top, and it's got a tie belt out of the same fabric, and of course it buttons down the front, and it has gathers on the sleeves and really full sleeves with big gathers at the cuff, and it has a tie, one of those ties that you can tie into a nice floppy bow at the top. Her brunette hair is parted in the middle and pulled in the back. She's laughing for the camera, and let's hear what she has to say. Best piece of advice from Rachel Bloom. You can't control the future by being nervous about it. That's a very useful thing I've learned from therapy. The belief that if I can excessively stress about something, then I can control what happens. Well, that's just not true. Best hidden talent? I'm pretty good at picking things up with my toes. They're very agile. The pinky toe on my left foot literally has a life of its own. Sometimes I can grab a pencil or a marker with just that one. Best pinch me moment? Seeing Mel Brooks, one of my top inspirations, backstage at his recent stand-up special in Las Vegas. I'd met him once before, so I thought he'd vaguely remember me, but he knew exactly who I was. He said, "Rachel, I love you. You're such a doll. I'll see you around L.A. So I went, "When? Where?" Best dream role? Harold Hill in The Music Man. Josh Groban and I actually have an ongoing bit about doing a gender-swapped version with him playing Marion the librarian. If anyone wants to produce that, we're down. Best escape? The tub. Except it's not so much about disconnecting now because I do everything there, including work. I have a bath caddy I can put my laptop on. I've written full songs in the tub. And finally, best karaoke song? Son of a Preacher Man by Dusty Springfield. It's the sexiest song in the world. Let's move now to the feeling good section of the magazine, and this is the breast cancer special. This time, it's interpersonal. All in this together is the heading for this article. Roughly 1 in 8 American women will develop invasive breast cancer in her lifetime, and so, in a way, will her family and friends, though the diagnosis of any illness, or even the news of increased risk, inevitably has an impact on a patient's relationships, the fallout is perhaps never more varied and unpredictable than the breast cancer. Hester Hill Schnipper, manager of oncology social work at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston and a 2-time breast cancer survivor herself, says, quote, "When a woman is diagnosed, I ask her to make a list of people she can depend on. I guarantee that when she looks at it a year later, she'll be wrong about at least one. Some people vanish while others you've never imagined would step up. And they do," end of quote. Will breast cancer strain bonds that were once considered unbreakable? Or will it be the catalyst that brings families together, fortifies marriages, and deepens friendships? Here, real-life stories of love put to the test. Mothers and daughters, there's no me without you, is our first article. Cassie Casada has a memory of sitting on her parents' bed at age 6, tossing her mother's prosthetic breast in the air and trying to catch it. Kathy, now 40 and a journalist in Mount Prospect, Illinois, says, quote, "One day I asked her what it was. She said, 'Oh, that's mine.' And she put it in her bra. I realized then my mom was different," end of quote. As a teenager, Kathy knew that her mother, aunt, and grandmother were diagnosed with breast cancer in their 30s. On Kathy's 21st birthday, her mom, Barbara, elaborated. When Kathy was a toddler, she accidentally kicked Barbara in the chest, causing pain that sent her to the doctor, then the oncologist. Without that kick, the disease, already at stage 3, would likely have gone undetected. Over the years, Barbara had several remissions and recurrences. In 2007, Kathy learned she was pregnant on the same day her mother learned that the intense headaches she'd been having were due to breast cancer that had spread to her brain. Kathy says, "I felt selfish because while I wanted her to meet her grandchild, I also wanted her there to guide me through being a new mom." As Barbara's pain became excruciating, however, Kathy shifted her focus from delivery room dreams to helping relieve her mom's suffering. Barbara died at 61, 6 months before Kathy's son was born. The mother-daughter bond, quote, "may be the most complicated and layered of all human relationships," end of quote, says social worker Hester Hill Schnipper. "When you put breast cancer in the mix, things get even more complex," she says, quote, "there are so many intense feelings, sadness, anger, guilt, terror," end of quote. What's more, as women have children at older ages, oncologists are likely seeing more breast cancer patients with small children. And although breast cancer in young women is still rare, more than 250,000 women living in the U.S. today were diagnosed before age 40, according to the Young Survival Coalition, meaning some mothers face the painful task of watching their daughter battle the illness. In many cases, the cancer may be successfully treated within a year or so, and the family can move on. But when a woman has recurrences or develops an incurable form, quote, "cancer can become a lifelong companion," end of quote, Schnipper says. Breast cancer has loomed over the Henning family of Grayson, Georgia, for half a decade. Jill, a 50-year-old former pastor, beat the disease in 2013, only to have it metastasize last year. She's outlived her initial prognosis, but doctors can't predict how long she'll continue to respond to treatment. So she's committed to making memories with her daughters, Ashley, 16, and Sarah, 21. Jill has always shown up at cross-country meets to cheer on Ashley. The cancer has spread to her lungs, making yelling difficult, but she's still there, ringing a brass bell. Having a mom staring down incurable breast cancer can be especially tough for a teenager. Ashley says, quote, "My friends are thinking about math tests, boys, whether they'll make varsity. I have those worries too, plus I have this other thing to think about," end of quote. Then there's the guilt she feels when she and Jill bicker. It hits her, and she says, quote, "Oh shoot, mom has cancer. I should cherish my time with her," end of quote. Ashley is grateful and says the cheering bell, which used to embarrass her, has become her secret weapon. Quote, "I start hearing it a quarter mile away, and the sound motivates me to finish," end of quote. A mother with breast cancer may fear for her children's future, not just because she's leaving them behind. She may worry that they'll develop the disease, too. Jill had genetic screening to determine whether she carried the BRCA mutation, which would dramatically increase the risk for her daughters, and came up negative. But mothers who test positive may experience crippling self-blame, irrational though they may be. When Pittsburgh writer Debbie Tepper Glick, diagnosed with breast cancer in 2001 at age 48, got tested 4 years ago, she was crushed to find out she carried the BRCA2 mutation. And another test revealed her daughter did too. She said, quote, "I knew it wasn't my fault, but I was so sad this would be part of my legacy," end of quote. Sophia Garcia, Ph.D., a clinical psychologist at Chicago's Robert H. Lurie Comprehensive Cancer Center of Northwestern University, helps women like Glick reframe their discovery. And Robert says, quote, "It can be difficult to tell family members they carry a genetic mutation, but it can empower them to take proactive steps," end of quote, like getting tested themselves. Deborah Lindner, PMD, a physician from Chicago, discovered she was BRCA1 positive in 2007 and elected to have a double mastectomy. After delivering a daughter in 2012 and a son in 2013, she also had her ovaries removed. Instead of her family being haunted by the specter of illness, Lindner says she intends to raise health-conscious kids who, at age-appropriate time, will understand what breast cancer is and what they can do to prevent it. She says, quote, "It's like discussing safe sex practices. We give kids tools to help them deal with life's challenges," end of quote. Kathy Casada is now a mom to Ben, 11, and Kayla, 8. The kids spent the 10th anniversary of their grandma's death watching family videos and making pizza with her famous dough recipe. Casada says, quote, "I often think, how did my parents get through it? Not just the fear, but the physical and emotional demands of raising small kids when you're not well," end of quote. Those videos, though, bring back memories of how her mom was always there for her and her siblings, even when exhausted from chemo. Kathy hasn't yet told her kids the family's full cancer story. Maybe she'll share it, fateful kick and all, when Ben turns 21. She says, quote, "Just the way my mom told me," end of quote. The next part of the article is entitled Siblings, My Sister's Keeper. Catherine Gordon and her older sister Karen never had the chance to become close when they were young. At age 16, when Catherine was just 12, Karen became pregnant and moved out to marry her boyfriend. Over the ensuing decades, their lives took very different paths. They were drawn together for a fraught period in the late 90s when Karen was diagnosed with brain cancer. Catherine, living in Toronto, was working 90 hours a week at her corporate communications job, yet flew to Vancouver to be with Karen during treatment. Once the cancer was in remission, though, they returned to their hectic lives on opposite sides of the country. But about 10 years later, when Catherine's marriage was failing, Karen, who was divorced and remarried, reached out to offer support and advice. That's probably why, in 2015, when Catherine found a lump in her right breast, she knew whom to turn to, saying, quote, "Karen was one of the first people I called," end of quote. When a biopsy showed cancer, Karen, now living in California, again leaped into protective big sister mode. Catherine says, quote, "After my mastectomy, Karen flew out and stayed with us," end of quote. Midway through Catherine's chemo, Karen came back to Toronto again to attend her sister's treatments and try on wigs with her. Karen says, quote, "She gave my husband the week off and took care of me," end of quote. And then, almost 1 year to the day after Catherine's diagnosis, Karen called with some shocking news of her own, saying, quote, "You're not going to believe this, but I just found out I have breast cancer too," end of quote. Their roles were suddenly reversed, with Catherine taking the "everything's going to be all right" tone. Karen was nervous about telling their 82-year-old mother. Karen says, quote, "She's strong, but both daughters, and I'd already had brain cancer," end of quote. So Catherine calmly broke the news on a three-way call. Today, Catherine, 59, and Karen, 64, chat often just to check in or ask for advice, cancer-related and otherwise. This fall, they'll celebrate their good health at a family wedding, and they recently went to a gathering for their mom's birthday. Catherine says, quote, "My mom told everyone how happy she was to have us all together," end of quote. While all the cancer news was harrowing, it brought these two faraway sisters closer than they'd ever been. Cancer does sometimes breathe new life into a relationship. Clinical psychologist Sophia Garcia, PhD, says that when people learn they have a potentially life-threatening illness, it can motivate them to reevaluate what matters, and that often includes looking at their relationships. Dale P. Sandler, PhD, is the chief of the epidemiology branch at the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences and principal investigator of the large-scale sister study dedicated to sussing out the environmental, lifestyle, and genetic factors influencing breast cancer. And he says, quote, "We've seen sisters who were not close growing up coming together to learn about how their childhood circumstances and exposures may have contributed to their disease," end quote. The reminder of all they've shared, experiences, biology, can create a new bond. But it can also emphasize their differences, as Jordan Murphy, 28, a PR professional in Dallas, discovered. When her mother developed breast cancer and tested positive for the BRCA2 gene in 2014, her three daughters also underwent genetic testing. Jordan tested negative. Her sisters, Lauren, 33, and Leslie, 31, are positive like mom. Jordan was relieved by her result, saying, quote, "I saw an aunt die from cancer, and it was terrible," end of quote. But the news also ignited some long-standing feelings of envy. She says, quote, "My mom has always had a really close connection with my sisters, and now they have this new thing, the BRCA2 gene, in common. I almost feel left out," end of quote. As perverse as that might sound, Lauren sees where Jordan is coming from. Lauren says, quote, "She's the youngest and maybe already felt like she wasn't always in the same club," end of quote. After testing positive, Lauren, who plans to eventually have her ovaries and breasts removed, decided to become pregnant sooner rather than later, providing mom with her first grandchild. Meanwhile, Leslie underwent a prophylactic double mastectomy plus reconstruction, similar to what her mother had done. Bilateral risk-reducing mastectomy, like Leslie had and Lauren will have, has been shown to reduce risk of breast cancer by at least 95% in women with BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutation. Now she refers to mom as her boob twin. A travel blogger, Leslie often brings her mother on jet-setting adventures. As for Jordan, she'll get to keep her breasts, but won't have much peace of mind. She says, quote, "A year ago, I found a lump. The doctor said, you're still high risk and need to get ultrasounds every year. That was disheartening. I'm in my 20s, and I need annual ultrasounds," end of quote. Which is to say, it's complicated, just like sisterhood. And on a sidebar, we have this fact. A woman has a 50% chance of passing down a BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutation to the next generation. Women with a family history of breast cancer should start getting a clinical breast exam every 6 months and a mammogram every year, at least 10 years before the age of the earliest diagnosis in the family, but not before age 25 or after age 40, and that's from Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And now, on another sidebar, thanks to the 50,000-plus women who participated in the 10-year sister study, we now know, among other things, that higher levels of physical activity from age 5 to 19 are associated with a lower breast cancer risk, and that women exposed to tobacco smoke throughout childhood had a 17% higher breast cancer risk. Our next category is romantic partners, and cancer makes three. It's not surprising that breast cancer treatment, which can alter or destroy a woman's secondary sex characteristics, can also alter and destroy her body image and sex life. Besides the loss of sensation with surgery, chemotherapy can plunge a patient into temporary or permanent early menopause, aka chemopause. which comes with decidedly unsexy symptoms like vaginal dryness, weight gain, and an extinguished libido. Estrogen-blocking medications, which may be used for up to 10 years to lower recurrence risk, have similar effects. Before breast cancer survivor Bonnie Annis was diagnosed in 2014 at age 56, she and her husband of 20 years cherished their twice-a-week sex life. Then Annis had a double mastectomy, which she and her husband weighed the risks of reconstruction, and she decided against it. Her husband was a doting caregiver, helping her get dressed in the morning and adjusting her pillows at night to accommodate the drainage bulbs in her chest. When Annis's libido returned about 4 months post-surgery, she was at first elated, then crushed to find her spouse's desire had fizzled. She says, quote, "I did my best to look pretty. I made sure my makeup was just right. I put on lingerie, but it didn't matter. He treated me as if I was fragile, like he might hurt me if he touched me," end of quote. Annis woke one night to hear her 6'4" rock of a husband weeping beside her. He revealed he was terrified of losing her to a recurrence. He was also saddened by the changes in her personality. Indeed, Annis agrees that cancer transformed her from an outgoing people person to a reclusive agoraphobic, afraid to leave home without prosthetics. She says, quote, "He felt like he didn't know me anymore," end of quote. The worst part, her husband admitted he missed her pre-cancer body. She says, quote, "He grieved what he considered the loss of my femininity and, yes, my breasts," end of quote. The chasm between them widened a few months later when she discovered he'd been using the tablet she'd given him for Christmas to view porn, which he said was a new practice for him. When he came home from work to find the tablet smashed in the driveway, he confessed that he'd been trying to escape into a fantasy world. Annis was devastated. She says, quote, "I thought he'd accepted my mastectomies as necessary, but I was wrong. I began to second-guess my decision not to reconstruct," end of quote. 3 years later, Annis says she and her husband are still deeply in love. She says, "We hug, kiss, and cuddle, and we function as a team. But they're no longer sexually intimate." She says, quote, "We've both accepted that our marriage has changed. But while cancer broke my body, we won't let it break us," end of quote. Jamie Padigo, 37, of Spring Hill, Kansas, says her breast cancer experience was so traumatizing, she went on antidepressants. She says, quote, "Not only was I a new mom with cancer, but within 2 weeks of diagnosis, my doctors were expecting my husband and me to make huge decisions, like whether we wanted to freeze embryos," end of quote. When Padigo began feeling relief from the medication, she encouraged her husband to try it too. She says, quote, "The stress was taking a toll. He would lose his cool very quickly, then come back 10 minutes later crying and apologizing. Plus, he felt like so much attention was on me, but he needed support too," end of quote. Now they're relieved to be depression-free, off the meds and back to laughing together. However, the experience caused lasting damage, says Padigo. Quote, "It killed whatever sex drive we had left," end of quote. Sex is often the elephant in the doctor's office. It loomed over Mark Silver of Chevy Chase, Maryland, and his wife, Marcia Dale, planned her breast cancer treatment in 2001. He says, quote, "I wanted to ask her oncologist if we could still have sex, but how could I? Wouldn't that make me seem self-centered?" End of quote. Silver instead found himself constantly striving to be the world's best partner. When a physician recommended bilateral mastectomy, he jumped in and told Dale he'd love her no matter what. And he says, quote, "She looked at me and said, 'How would you feel if the doctor told you he needed to cut off your penis?'" End of quote. A goes on to say, quote, she didn't want me to be Mr. Fix-It. She needed me to listen to her talk about how she felt, end of quote. Silver wrote the book Breast Cancer Husband for partners like him, and 14 years later, it's still popular. Social worker Hester Hill Schnipper says many spouses struggle. She says, quote, a husband often acts as chief cheerleader during his wife's treatment, but he may be angry, scared of losing her, or overwhelmed, and he likely feels guilty about being anything other than completely supportive, end of quote. A patient in a same-sex partnership can experience her own unique difficulties. In some cases, introducing her wife or girlfriend to doctors can feel like coming out over and over. Liz Margulies, a licensed clinical social worker and founder and executive director of the National LGBTQ Cancer Network, says, quote, LGBT cancer patients have to weigh the value of being open against their concerns about discrimination at a time when they may be least equipped to fight it. Yet if the patient stays silent, her partner may feel invisible. Negotiating every encounter this way puts pressure on relationships, end of quote. On the other hand, Margulies notes, queer women tend to report feeling less pressure to get breast reconstruction, and she's heard from patients that their partners are often more accepting of their decision to go flat than men in heterosexual relationships might be. That doesn't mean there's no emotional conflict in foregoing reconstruction. Being with a partner who has two healthy breasts, quote, can be a constant reminder of the body a patient used to have before treatment, end of quote, Margulies says. For their part, Silver and Dale have maintained intimacy by redefining erogenous zones and navigating satisfaction. Quote, there are back rubs, foot massages, end of quote, Silver says. Dale, whose hair loss made her self-conscious, recalls her husband taking pains to help her feel beautiful when he removed her wig to make love. Silver says, quote, she has a lovely bald head, and her ears are sort of elfin. Cancer splits you apart, and your home feels overrun with medication, bills, and reminders of the disease. It's so important to do things that bring you together and allow you for a few moments to forget all that, end of quote. Humor can smooth bumps in the road, too. Ashley Bream, 36, of Omaha, says jokes were a crucial coping mechanism for her and her husband as she underwent treatment for stage 2 cancer in 2015. At a Bon Boobvage party before her double mastectomy, he was the bartender, serving up mamaritas and slippery nipples. And as Bream's hair started growing back after chemo, he helped her name each new look, the M&M, the Ellen, the Keith Urban. Bream says, quote, look, I'm a 36-year-old in menopause. We need a gallon of lube just to have sex. We have to find what's funny because otherwise it would be too sad, end of quote. And our final section of this article is called Friends. It takes a village. In 2017, Jamie Dahl, then 43, and Julie Nordine, then 44, were best friends from high school living happily parallel lives. Their houses in La Crosse, Wisconsin, were two blocks from each other, their birthdays one day apart, their kids the same ages. Then Dahl learned in March of that year that she had breast cancer. She told Nordine the next day after drop-off in the school parking lot. Nordine was stunned, not only because this was happening to her dearest friend, but also because she'd felt a lump in her own breast a couple of months earlier. 2 days later, the radiologist who'd helped diagnose Dahl pointed to a mass on Nordine's ultrasound. A biopsy confirmed breast cancer. Nordine's chemo started first, so she helped Dahl's kids get comfortable with a bald head by letting them rub hers. Dahl was first to go through double mastectomy and reconstruction. Her daughter, then 8, taught Nordine's sons how to give hugs post-surgery without hurting their mom. Twice, the friends had simultaneous chemo sessions, during which they'd walk their IV bags down the hall to say hi. Quote, Jamie had just gotten her Benadryl, end of quote, administered for nausea, and, quote, and she was looped, end of quote, Nordine says, laughing. Quote, when she saw me, she burst out, wow, you're beautiful, end of quote. Dahl and Nordine offered each other a shoulder to cry, laugh, and lean on. Marissa Kangen, PsyD, an assistant clinical professor of psychology with the City of Hope in Duarte, California, says, quote, your connections with friends and family are the number one way to nurture your emotional health, which is critical during and after treatment, end of quote. Of course, Nordine and Dahl's situation, from best friends to breast cancer friends, is unusual. More often, it's the other way around. Social worker Hester Schnipper explains, quote, cancer buddies, the ones you meet in waiting rooms or support groups, become so close, so fast, you can immediately talk to each other in an authentic way, end of quote. When Lori Marks Rubiner from Encino, California, and Anne Marie Ciccarella from Long Beach, New York, found each other on social media in 2011, they had little in common besides a rare type of breast cancer. Ciccarella, then 54, with a son and daughter in their early 20s, had been finished with treatment for 4 years and was struggling in a troubled marriage. Marks Rubiner, at the time 45, had a teenage son and was happily married to her college sweetheart. Yet the two hit it off, and soon their bond went beyond cancer. Ciccarella says, quote, we'd visit and talk for hours. It was like we shared the same brain, end of quote. But in 2017, Marks Rubiner told Ciccarella she was halting her treatment. When Ciccarella realized what that meant, she rushed to her friend's side. 2 weeks later, at Marks Rubiner's funeral, Ciccarella was overcome with grief. She thought, why am I still here and Lori isn't? Survivor's guilt is not uncommon among breast cancer friend groups. Clinical psychologist Sophia Garcia, PhD, says it often includes the minimizing of one's own experience. The survivor may even have the irrational feeling that she's somehow at fault. Schnipper encourages survivors to remember that no matter what, they've paid their dues and recommends finding an oncology-savvy therapist. Breast cancer doesn't always bring friends closer. After discovering a lump in her left breast in 2014, Jocelyn Mader, now 36, started a Facebook page to update friends and family during her treatment for stage 3 cancer. At first, friends rallied. Co-workers raised nearly $2,000 to help her cover medical costs. But as she blogged in raw detail about chemo, lumpectomy, lymph node removal, and 38 sessions of radiation, the calls dwindled. When friends disappear, Garcia says, quote, it's often because they don't know what to do, or the cancer feels threatening to their own mortality. You're entitled to feel angry, but it's important to acknowledge that while you can't control your friend's response, you can control whether you rebuild those relationships, end of quote. Mader eventually forced herself not to take the disappearances personally. Having a few heart-to-hearts helped, Mader says, quote, I reached out to one friend and I told her I missed her. She said she'd had some great things happen, like a promotion, and worried that if she shared them, I'd feel hurt. She also admitted that it terrified her when I was diagnosed at such a young age, end of quote. Over coffee and a good cry, the two reconnected. For besties Dahl and Nordine, their friendship has not only survived cancer, but thrived. There was one awkward moment when they found out Dahl would need 4 rounds of chemo compared with Nordine's 6. Nordine says, quote, part of me felt like I had to stay after school while she got to go out to recess, but I was thrilled for her, end of quote. And Dahl admits she sometimes worries that her friend will look at her and be reminded of a terrible time in their lives. But Nordine insists cancer has only strengthened the bond. She recalls, quote, the day before my mastectomy, we were sitting on a low wall in my front yard. A car drove by, and the woman just stared. I said to Jamie, what's she, never seen two bald girls sitting on a wall talking? We died laughing, end of quote. And on the sidebars, we have a couple of statistics. 70% of breast cancer survivors suffer sexual problems in the first 2 years after their diagnosis. One small study found that women diagnosed with cancer were about 5 times more likely to divorce or separate than men who got cancer. A 2017 study of more than 9,000 women with breast cancer found that those who were socially isolated had a 43% higher risk of a recurrence and 64% higher risk of dying from breast cancer compared with counterparts who had large social support networks. We'll switch gears now, and as we wrap up this second installment, let's look at the O-List Pet Edition. And on the very first page, we have this tall, skinny, white-haired, short-haired dog wearing some booties. She walks in booty like the night is the heading. The open-vented slits make these wellies simple to get on, and the secure fit offers excellent protection from salt that irritates paws when dogs walk on slushy streets or knock back a couple of margaritas. Wag Wellies, originally $64, now 20% off with code Oprah at wagwear.com. And as I said, these are green and they have straps, Velcro straps, that wrap around and hold them on to the dog's paws. And next, Born to be Styled. Here's the leather collar with a bead or ribbon trim that'll take a pet from office to night on the town, or at the very least, from sofa to chair. Boho and Beads collars, originally from $42 each, now 20% off with code Oprah, at dogwithamission.com. And they're a dark tan leather with the bead and ribbon patterns are sort of a Native American inspired pattern. One is green and red with those little diamond shapes in multiple colors that I think are called God's eyes. And then the other one, the ribbon, is light blue and dark blue and purple. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Susan Dellinger, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.